If it's Tuesday, it's 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're marking the 70th anniversary of Meet the Press with the program's moderator, Chuck Todd, its executive producer, John Reese, and with you. Share your questions and thoughts about today's politics or about Meet the Press through the years. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Dennis commented on our website, the1A.org, I am 70 and have enjoyed Meet the Press since the Kennedy years. I lived the hippie artist life in the 60s and was lucky to draw political illustrations for the op-ed pages of the New York Times. One feature illustration was for a James Reston article on Nixon going to China. The youth and liberals then knew full well the threats of ultra-conservative law and order, religious fundamental impact on political and social free expression, and abortion and racism. Bad law then, and the threat of bad law now. Happily, I follow and really respect both Chuck Todd as a fine, young, smart, vibrant news professional for all his quality news production and constantly adding to our national dialogue and world understanding. Chuck, no pressure.
Yeah, well, I'll you know, thanks, Dad. No, I'm kidding. My father's deceased. Yeah. Look, that's nice. That's nice to hear. Look, here's what I always say about trying to put on Meet the Press, especially in this more polarized climate that we're in these days, is what I really hope is that every week, everybody watches and feels as if some point of view of theirs is challenged for at least 5 minutes in some form or another. I don't care if you're left, right, libertarian, green, in the middle, whatever it is. And I'm hoping that at some point you also have 5 minutes where you feel like someone is channeling exactly your view or sort of making you feel is understand, you know, feel as if, okay, somebody is listening to me or somebody does share my point of view in this political debate as well. It's more challenging all the time, right? Because you do have viewers, you do have more and more viewers are trying to tune into news looking for affirmation and not information. And obviously we still believe that as noisy and as crowded as the climate is these days, that Sunday morning is still a place where people actually are looking for information.
Now, I also think, you know, my position, I sit in the control room and I listen to and watch the show. I try to take the position of the viewer. What does the viewer want to see and want to hear? And one of the things that always strikes me is that a good moderator, and Chuck is an excellent moderator, asks the questions that the viewer wants asked. That is a regular goal for us each week. And I think we've been pretty successful at that.
John Reese, when Meet the Press began back in 1947, obviously the media landscape was vastly, vastly different than what it is right now. I wonder, in an age where we're basically talking politics 24 hours a day, whether we like to or not, what the role of this Sunday program is. You have Meet the Press Daily now on MSNBC. You have Meet the Press starting now a documentary film festival, which is going to kick off very soon. If it hasn't kicked off already, you're doing more with podcasting. What do we need Sunday for? What's the role of the Sunday show?
You know, it's a great question. When we started about 3 years ago, I started collecting all the columns and op-ed pieces that I had seen that said basically there are two steps Meet the Press needs to take. The first is follow these few suggestions of ours, and when you're done with that, go to step two, which is take it off the air, because who needs these Sunday shows anymore? We've got cable 24/7. You've got the morning shows on cable. We don't have to wait till Sunday to hear a politician and politicians' talking points. And I think we've proven, and not just us, I think all the Sunday shows have proven their worth and why they're valuable. One of the things that cable does is it blots out the sun. The most important thing on cable always, and I straddle this. We're in Meet the Press Daily, which is cable, and Meet the Press. The most important thing on cable tends to be what just happened. That is the very thing that we try to avoid on Sunday. We don't want to fall so in love with what we have that we ignore what happens on Saturday or Sunday, but we also don't want to let what just happened, what just broke, get in the way of what we think is the most important development during the week. And I think that's the role that we play, that we're a bit of a Sunday paper. And I mean that in a good way. I realize that could be a pejorative.
Right.
But
we're not a dead tree, buddy.
right. But I mean that in a good way, and that the whole idea of the Sunday paper was that you actually could sit down and spend some time thinking about the news of the week. And I think that is what we try desperately to do.
Chuck, describe the week at Meet the Press. You are on television, I think, 8 or 9 days a week, it seems like, and the workload has got to be gigantic. How do you manage the daily grind right. against trying to create some perspective on Sunday? How does a week of the show work?
Well, look, first of all, I sort of was raised on a 24/7 news diet and professionally. And why do I say that? My first basically professional job was working for a small little startup publication at the time. It was called The Hotline. And it was a daily publication covering campaign politics, covering what was happening. And it was very much for professionals. It was written for the folks involved professionally in the world of politics. So it was very much for Washington, if you will, and for state capitals and things like that. This is in 1992. Looking back, we were aggregators. We were the internet before the internet. We just didn't know it at the time. But my day always started about 4:30 in the morning, and it was always this idea. We churned out a publication every day by 11:40 every morning. My point is this: the hardest thing about taking over Meet the Press 3 years ago was losing my daily show. In that I have always been sort of in a news, one of these that just I've consumed. I've got a daily and almost hourly news diet, so I am more comfortable that way. So I look at us starting Meet the Press daily, it actually makes Sunday easier, not harder. I think Sunday was harder for me when each day I'm thinking, well, if Sunday were today, we'd do this, and if Sunday were today, we'd do that. Well, now I do have, if it were Sunday, this is what we do because we have Meet the Press daily. So you say, for the Sunday show, you know, we have our first conversations about potential panelists maybe on Tuesday. On Wednesday, we're starting to have a conversation of what would be our palate cleanser story of the day, meaning it's a issue or a person or an idea that we want to surface, but it's not a lead. So maybe at the bottom of the show, at the half hour point, that's our C block, but internally, but meaning that's where I'd like to have, like, if we're going to introduce a new idea, or a couple weeks ago, I had the fire chief from Huntington, West Virginia, who's basically her full-time job is dealing with the opioid epidemic and her sharing her firsthand account. So my point is that wasn't a week where the opioids were the lead story, but it was on the Wednesdays and Thursdays, we're contemplating that.
Right.
But in the Trump era, where he makes news himself, sometimes on Twitter on Saturdays and Sundays, you know, we do book the top of the show later and later than ever these days because of how quickly things can change.
And you had mentioned earlier taking over the show. We should play a little bit of archival tape from Meet the Press. And John, I'll come back to you in just one second, including from one of the predecessors of yours, Chuck, which was, of course, Tim Russert. Here is a clip of Meet the Press from the 2004 presidential campaign in which George W. Bush was questioned by Tim Russert about his military service.
The Boston Globe and the Associated Press have gone through some of the records and said there's no evidence she reported for duty in Alabama during the summer and fall of 1972.
Yeah, they're just wrong. There may be no evidence, but I did report. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been honorably discharged. In other words, you don't just say I did something without there being verification. The military doesn't work that way. I got an honorable discharge, and I did show up in Alabama.
You did. We're allowed to leave 8 months before your term expired. Is there a reason?
Right. Well, I was going to Harvard Business School and worked it out with the military.
That was Tim Russert questioning George W. Bush in 2004. Let me play one more clip, and then, John, I'd love to get your sense on kind of how Tim Russert did what he did. This was former President Barack Obama. His first presidential campaign was kind of haunted by these charges of being too outside the American mainstream. This is Tim Russert interviewing Barack Obama on Meet the Press in 2007.
Have you been sufficiently tested and vetted? Are there any surprises? Is there anything the American people should know?
There are no surprises, in part because the Clinton campaign has done a thorough research job on us. If there was anything out there, I promise you, they would have found it by now, which is why they ended up resorting to some of the stuff that you're talking about. The only reason people know it is because I disclosed it. And some of it was completely false. Now, look, I have been written about, I have been scrubbed, I have been vetted over the last year. I'm sure if you talk to my wife, she could point out a few more flaws in my character. But the fact of the matter is that the people of Iowa, and I think the people of America, at this point, know what I stand for.
That was Barack Obama speaking to Tim Russert in 2007. John Reese, we often talk about this idea of holding politicians' feet to the fire. And Tim Russert was brilliant at that. But what does that actually mean? Is it just asking pointed questions? Is it your demeanor on the air? Is it digging up dirt? What was it that Tim Russert did that was so special in terms of keeping politicians accountable?
You know, prior to when Tim came on the show, Meet the Press really was about, in many ways, meeting the press. Tim changed that dynamic. And with longer interviews and sort of more prosecutorial interviews. Part of that is great research. Part of that is the fact that Tim was a lawyer and knew how to do this. And I think Chuck has done very much the same thing. We have an astonishing group of producers and researchers who put together so much research on every guest and every subject that I don't get through it. I'm amazed that Chuck does read through every page. I wonder sometimes when I hear Chuck ask a question, I think, how in the world did he know that? And then later I look back at the research. Oh, yeah, this was on page 73 of the research. So that has a lot. I mean, preparation is everything. Obviously, like when you're talking about Chuck, you're talking about one of the leading political minds in the country. So in some cases, he doesn't need the research. He just knows it. But a lot of work goes into making it look easy.
There's also the aspect, Chuck, of being in Washington or near Washington, at least, and covering Washington. I mean, you've been in Washington for some time. You mentioned 92 is when you started at the hotline. And there's always this perception among the public, particularly today, that we're just too damn cozy with the people that we cover. We all know the same people. Yeah. Y'all hang out at the same parties. Your kids go to the same schools. Right. You know, people kind of drift from government to policy, to media, to politics, to a think tank and back to government. Maybe they'll run for office and maybe they'll get a show on cable news and maybe they'll write a column. And it's all super incestuous to the point that we don't really know who is an honest broker. Right. How do you keep yourself an honest broker?
You know, it's interesting. I'm one of those that is both concerned about it and used to be somebody that would spitball about it. As somebody at the hotline, I'd feel like, ah, boy, those television news people, they're too, you know, they're only talking to the same 10 people. They're not doing this. And as sort of, you know, and I think the 25-year-old me was very much filled with a lot of that criticism. Look, being on the other side, you learn a lot more on sort of how the sausage is made in the world of television.
And Chuck, I'm sorry, I hate to interrupt you, but since you made that point, that dovetails into a tweet from one of our listeners, that very thing. Billy wrote, I respect the show, but I wish Meet the Press featured a new array of voices each week instead of a privileged club of professional pundits.
Yeah, no. And look, it's something that we go back and forth, and we try our best to, and I think we've done a better job of this over the last 3 years than some of our competitors. We do try to find new voices and incorporate them. You want to put on I struggle with this for another reason. Politics sometimes is the only industry where the public wants inexperience. It's funny. We want experience. We want somebody who has got a deep resume and knowledge when it comes to medicine. We want somebody who has a deep array of knowledge and when it comes to, you know, technology. But God forbid, if you understand how Washington works, we don't want that kind of experience sometimes. But I'm going to set that aside. But that is a unique aspect of politics that I think sometimes seeps into media criticism. But let me go to the larger point of your question here, which is this idea of the insiders. I'll tell you this. I do worry about that perception. I think this, you know, I always say the original sin happened back in the late 60s. Okay. The original sin was when the industry of television at one point decided, you know, maybe Pat Buchanan and Bill Moyers, one worked for Richard Nixon, one worked for LBJ. Maybe we should hire them and make them into analysts and journalists. You know, that is when the door opened. Right. And I do think there is a, I understand why some of the public sit there and say, well, wait a minute. They used to work in government. Now they work in journalism, whatever it is, that back and forth. So I understand that line got blurred over time. I'll tell you this. I'm interested in rebuilding the wall a little bit. You know, I've never been a big socializer in D.C., so I don't do that. I actually think that can sometimes contribute to the chumminess and the clubbiness of everything. You know, I think the best piece of advice that I always give to young journalists, I say, it actually came from a guy named Lester Bangs, the character in Almost Famous, when Philip Seymour Hoffman, who of course is no longer with us, says to the young reporter as he's about to go off on this tour, he says, "Don't make friends with the rock stars." And I think that is a piece of advice I think about all the time. You know, these elected officials, these party operatives, they're not your friends. At the end of the day, they will throw you under the bus to get elected. So just do your job. Cover them. Be courteous. There's nothing wrong with being courteous. There's nothing wrong with having professional relationships with these folks. And there's nothing wrong with over time making friends with people. But know that there is a line and John, stick to it.
John, I wonder briefly, do you ever find yourself having to, either for Chuck or for anyone on the team, kind of pull back and say, no, not that party. No, not this get together. Maybe that's a little too close. No, just no.
No, not really, because I'm one of the least social people in Washington. Very much a homebody, so that has not been an issue for me. But I mean, to expand on Chuck's point, I think one of the things that we have to do as we approach each show is to question our own premises. People who work in journalism have strong opinions. And our staff is no exception. But one of the things we tell them is, okay, you're allowed to have strong opinions, but we leave those opinions, leave them at the door. Because we're not on the air on Sunday or frankly, Monday to Friday to advocate a position. And so, and look, that's one of the challenges is to not allow your own prejudices to be reflected on the show.
Maybe to that point, Steve in Orlando, Florida writes, "It has been said we have the right to freedom of speech, but no one has the right to yell fire in a crowded movie house. That begs the question, what if there is a fire? At what point does a journalist put aside impartiality and yell fire?" Good question. And I wonder, Chuck, John, how you navigate that. At what point, where do you stop being a moderator and start saying, hey, something's really wrong? Stay close. Before we get back to our conversation, there is another milestone of broadcasting that we should mention today involving a very well-known Texan. Today is the 50th birthday of public broadcasting. On this date in 1967, President Lyndon Johnson signed the Public Broadcasting Act into law. The act created the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private, nonprofit agency funded by the American people. It does not produce any programming, own any stations, or control any networks. Its main job is to fund local TV and radio stations across the country to create their own shows or acquire them from public networks like PBS and NPR. PBS was formed in 1970. NPR came along in 71. Today, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting supports more than 1,100 radio stations and more than 360 TV stations. It accounts for less than 1/100th of 1% of the federal budget, but it reaches virtually the entire American population. And it provides the backbone for emergency alerts in many communities, including Amber Alerts. The Public Broadcasting Act, signed into law 50 years ago. Today. Back now to our conversation with the moderator of NBC's Meet the Press, Chuck Todd, and John Reese, the program's executive producer. We welcome more of your questions and thoughts as well. Email 1A at WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. I wonder if we could get back to the question from Steve in Orlando, Florida. Steve writes, "It has been said that we have the right to freedom of speech, but no one has the right to yell fire in a crowded movie house. It begs the question, what if there is a fire? At what point do journalists put aside impartiality and yell fire. I wonder if maybe that's a good place to play a clip from Meet the Press from just this year. 2 days after President Trump was sworn into office, spokesperson Kellyanne Conway came on to Meet the Press and said this.
Excuse me, it does not excuse, and you did not answer the question.
I did answer your question.
No, you did not. You did not answer the question of why the president asked the White House press secretary to come out in front of the podium for the first time and utter a falsehood. Why did he do that? It undermines the credibility of the entire White House press office on day one.
Don't be so overly dramatic about it, Chuck. What you're saying, it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Wait a minute. Alternative facts? Alternative facts, four of the five facts he uttered. The
one thing he got right, Chuck,
was Zeke Miller. Four of the five facts he uttered were just not true. Look, alternative facts are not facts. They're falsehoods.
That was Chuck Todd engaging Kellyanne Conway earlier this year on Meet the Press. We've gotten a lot of comments about Kellyanne Conway. John tweeted, CNN's Brian Stelter was criticized for having Kellyanne Conway on his show, Reliable Sources. How do you handle Kellyanne? And Patrick tweeted, sometimes I feel as if the guests try to control the conversation. They speak only their points and never really answer questions, like Kellyanne Conway. Sometimes I feel as if you fall for it and then let it go. That needs to be stopped. Chuck?
You know, it's interesting. Look, we're pretty picky. We don't accept certain guests, and I'm not going to say who the White House offers because I don't want to get into a name drop on this. But if it is somebody that is just going to do pablum, you know, or not, or sit there and just try to use the platform to create a false premise or something like that. You know, it's just, we're not going to allow ourselves to be used that way. And I think that I've been pretty clear about that internally, and we've been pretty clear about that and how we've tried to, how we try to question folks. Look, it's, you know, it's just a unique situation, right? We've not dealt with the White House. I made a big deal out of that first day for the reason, and I'm glad you played the entire question that I asked her on that, because I thought, on one hand, I can't believe we're having a debate about crowd size. On the other hand, I thought symbolically it was extraordinarily important that they chose to make this, that the first time they stood behind that podium, and we have talked about War and Peace behind that podium. We have talked about dead first graders behind that podium. We've talked about some important things that have happened to this country, that have shaken this country, behind that podium. That podium means something to the world, right? You see presidents speak behind that podium, and to just have it be sullied with an absolute falsehood on day one, to me, was symbolic enough to make a point out of it. But there's always that point where, you know, I've had a lot of people ask me, why didn't you call her a liar? Why did you use the word falsehood? Well, look, at the end of the day, I can't crawl inside their head, right? I don't know what the motive was. I don't know full-fledged motive on that. So I think there is this line you do, and it gets back to the tweet, that when is it a journalist's responsibility to say, well, there is a fire. Well, look, I look at it this way. You know, we can show the premise. We can ask a pointed question, sort of make it clear what they're doing. But there is a point where it is important for the viewer to, at the end of the day, make the conclusion. I think, you know, I want to stop short of drawing a conclusion for them. Okay.
Has Kellyanne Conway been back on Meet the Press since this interview?
No, she has not.
Okay, so the interview had an impact.
I think, look, I assume it did for a lot of people. I have not seen her on a lot. I was surprised to see her on CNN this weekend. Look.
I'm sorry, Chuck. I just mean whether it had an impact on the way that you booked Meet the Press. Not for other shows.
No, I think it is. But I would say this. I wish my colleagues would sometimes not get caught up in viral catnip.
You know, and
let me get. Go ahead, John.
I was just going to say that we're talking about people using their talking points, and one of the things that we have tried to do is sort of a preemptive strike, which is to say in the question, okay, we know that you believe this. We know that, let's say, we're talking about polls. We know that you're going to say that the only poll that counts is on election day. We know you're going to say that you have to see the enthusiasm in our crowds, but why are you behind by 5 points? And so that has generally been a fairly effective way to prevent the guest from going straight to talking points. It doesn't always work. Very recently, we tried very hard. We knew what the guest's talking points would be. We asked, formed a question that would presumably keep the guest away from the talking points, and went straight to them anyway. So it doesn't always work, and so the caller or tweeter was absolutely right. But it's something we're keenly aware of, and we try very hard to avoid.
Peggy in Tacoma Park, Maryland, emailed, "Why keep the Sunday show? Because some of us tune out a lot of the television politics coverage due to the constant rehashing of the outrage of the day.
Yes.
Especially nowadays, it's too much noise. If I didn't, my teeth would be ground to stumps. I watch PBS NewsHour, Washington Week, and Meet the Press every week. I rely on cable news just for big breaking stories. Oh, and I listen to 1A. And Harry in Mount Lebanon, Pennsylvania,
That's the perfect viewer for all of us, Joshua. Right?
Exactly, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Harry in Mount Lebanon, Pennsylvania writes, "There was no better moderator of Meet the Press than Larry Spivak." Sorry, fellas. In case you don't know who Larry Spivak is, here is a clip of him interviewing Fidel Castro 2 months after the revolution in April of 1959.
An American magazine published a story this week which says that Dr. Castro really hates America. Will you tell the American people how you feel about the United States?
Why am I going to hate to the people of the United States? I don't hate anybody, including my enemies, those who has been my strong enemy in Cuba. I don't hate them.
That was Lawrence E. Spivak, the former moderator of Meet the Press, interviewing Fidel Castro in April of 1959. Chuck Todd, I wonder what you have learned from the previous moderators. Obviously, Tim Russert, mm-hmm. Tom Brokaw has moderated the program, Roger Mudd, Roger Kalb, Lawrence Spivak. There's such a deep well. I think I mentioned Tom Brokaw. There's such a deep well to draw from. Yeah. How much do you learn from them, and how much do you keep as your own kind of fingerprint on the show?
Because my good friend Marvin Kalb might be listening. It's Marvin.
Marvin
on that.
I'm sorry. Did I say Marvin?
No worries. But especially because Marvin might be listening. I think he probably is a listener. He lives around.
To you, Mr. Kalb, I apologize.
Exactly. Somebody who I've spent a good deal of time with picking their brain. You know, it's interesting. I did something that I learned that Tim had done. Which is I've read a bunch of transcripts from, you know, it's not easy actually to watch old shows with Spivak or the old format. So, for instance, I toyed with bringing the old format back, the idea of bringing back other questioners. You know, the idea of being the original America's Press Conference of the Air is how it was booked. And at the time, that was a unique thing, having a group of journalists be able to question a politician. You didn't have it. You didn't see it. It didn't happen. But it was interesting. I read those, and because a lot of people had made this suggestion to me. Good friends did, media reporters did, you know. And so I looked into it a lot. I thought going in I wanted to do this. And then I read all the transcripts of the group questioning of back in the way from the early 80s, pre-Tim era, 70s, 60s. And you realized what happens when you have three different people asking somebody a question, or who are three different people in charge of questioning somebody. It really is a press conference, and it goes all over the place. Now, at moments, that's interesting, but there were a lot of missed follow-ups. That's what I noticed in there, and I thought at the end of the day, look, Tom Brokaw put it best. He said, Meet the Press has had two founding fathers. Okay, Lawrence Spivak was, you know, Martha Roundtree obviously was the first moderator, but Lawrence Spivak in many ways sort of... he made Meet the Press this, you know, as John Kennedy called it, the 51st state, right? He sort of created the idea of making it what it is, of what it was. And then Tim modernized it. You know, he's the one that took it to an hour. He's the one that got rid of the questioners and realized a longer single questioner interview can actually elicit a lot more information to the viewer, a lot more usefulness to the viewer. And that there was a lot of wisdom in you know, creating the political roundtable. That was something that Tim made permanent. So, I, you know, I have learned a lot from other moderators in different ways, but I've also view my job as, okay, what am I doing to make sure Meet the Press is prepared for the next 25 years? Which, of course, has been why I've been on this, like, okay, it can't be just a Sunday show. It's got to be a lot more.
And I can tell you, well, Joshua, but, that the alternative facts moment, which is really the signal moment of our show this year, would not have happened in a group format. If you played a lot of that bite, and that was terrific. But if you watched the whole show, that was about the fourth or fifth time that Chuck questioned Kellyanne Conway about what had happened the day before. With the group interview, you never would have had that. We talked about this at great length about whether or not we wanted to go back to the old style. And we, in fact, in a few cases early on, we tried it. This just works better with one moderator and one questioner.
In terms of the structure and the style of Meet the Press, John, particularly for you as the executive producer who's kind of overseeing the whole show, where do you see that Meet the Press has room to improve?
Well, I think, look, what I just mentioned, I thought that we've done a couple of things. One, as I said, when Chuck asks questions, we try to get people, try very hard to get people off the talking points. Secondly, we've added, the data download is something that you don't see elsewhere. It is very much part of Chuck's brand. And it has been sort of, I think, a touchstone for viewers, based at least on the anecdotal evidence we get. People enjoy that. It has separated us from the other guys, and something that if you look at any Sunday show over the years, you haven't seen. So we try to do something different. We try very hard to do something that's fun at the end of the show. I've often said that this doesn't have to be spinach. The whole show doesn't have to be spinach. You want this to be an enjoyable viewer experience. And I hope that's what we've brought people.
So is that kind of where and I know our time is short, but is that kind of where you're trying to keep the program moving? I mean, I know Meet the Press is an institution, and there's so much that you cannot monkey around with. But, John, is that kind of where you're looking to keep the show improving in terms of keeping it from just feeling like raw spinach every Sunday?
Well, absolutely. And look, one of the things Tim did a lot of 20, 25-minute interviews. We don't do that very much anymore. And part of it is the expected viewer experience. Viewers don't know that they have the patience for, except when we talk to a president or a former president, 25, 30-minute interviews. Even when we had President Obama in our very first show, what we did was we broke up the interview. We had 10 or 15 minutes of the president, and then we talked to the panel. Another 5, 10 minutes, we talked to the panel. So we've changed the pacing of the show. Right. And because I think viewers' expectations have changed.
But you know,
let
Joshua,
me get to
I'll
a few
be,
more comments.
I'll be very quick on this. Yep. I do wish I could do a 30-minute interview every week. Mm-hmm. That's why I started a podcast.
There you go. Let me get to a few more comments before we are out of time. Kay in Silver Spring, Maryland writes, "One of my earliest childhood memories is my father shushing me during Meet the Press with Lawrence Spivak. In my 70s, I still watch, then repeat with the C-SPAN radio rebroadcast. Months back, Chuck, you were quite aggressive pinning down Kellyanne on some point. I wanted to tell you, please stay forceful, seeking the truth, as our democracy depends on the integrity of the press in these very strange times." Before we go, Chuck, I have to ask you, do you ever get tired of politics? Do you ever just unplug and be like, I ain't reading Politico today? You know, to hell with the Washington Post. I'll read the Washington Post on Monday. Do you ever unplug?
Honestly, I've been looking for more ways than ever. I could tell you, the hardest day of the week for me in the fall happens to be Saturdays. I am an obsessive college football fan, beginning with the university, beginning with my love for the University of Miami.
There you go, Cocaines.
Go Canes. And I have to tell you, this is a real challenge this year. Miami's good. They play now on Saturday nights. When Miami wasn't so hot, they were playing noon games and 3:30 games. Now what I'm saying is, that's my unplug. That's what I love to sort of tune out. I'll admit, I watch a lot of, when I go home at night during the week, after a long day and after thinking about this all day long, give me a junk sitcom any day of the week. I don't know if it's a Family Guy or I've been binging It's Always Sunny, but sometimes I need something that is totally actually mindless, because you get yourself demoralized if you don't.
Chuck Todd, rabid Miami Hurricanes fan, they're 8-0 right now, and the moderator of Meet the Press. Chuck, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you, Joshua. This was great.
And John Reese, the executive producer of Meet the Press. John, thank you.
Thank you.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Many thanks to Houston Public Media for hosting us here these last few days. John Donvan will be with you tomorrow from Washington, D.C. But until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.